From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later tonight, Angels. Here's what's happening. Well, just a few months back, some scientists had hoped that summer conditions might help tamp down the coronavirus transmission. Studies have shown that simulated sunlight can inactivate the virus on surfaces and in the air. And one study found that the virus deteriorates much more quickly in warmer temperatures than in cool temperatures. Some of the other coronaviruses that have long circulated in the population tend to peak in colder months and wane in the summer months. And some thought that summer heat and humidity could work to slow down the spread of the COVID-19. Yet case counts of the coronavirus continue to surge here in the United States, recently hitting another single-day record of new infections. There are three likely reasons, according to public health officials. They say they do have the current levels of immunity in the population, the transmission of the virus continues, and how do people behave? They blame those three reasons. Immunity to COVID-19 in the population is still low, according to the experts, giving the virus lots of opportunities to spread. In one study published in the journal Science in May, researchers developed a model to see how seasonal changes in climate might affect the way COVID-19 spreads in cities in U.S. areas around the world. California's governor has clamped new restrictions on businesses, and the state's two largest school districts, Los Angeles and San Diego, said children would not return to class for the new term as the coronavirus cases and hospitalizations soared. Governor Gavin Newsom, a Democrat, ordered bars closed and restaurants, movie theaters, zoos, and museums statewide to cease indoor operations. Newsom said churches, gyms, hair salons must close in the 30th hardest hit counties. Man, it's getting hit. It's in a situation where people are just very upset here in California. President Donald Trump's executive clemency to his longtime friend and advisor, Roger Stone, not only commuted the veteran Republican operative's prison term, but it also spared him a hefty fine and 2 years of supervised release. Roger's on the phone with us now. Roger, you must be on cloud nine today.
Well, I'm very happy because God has answered my prayers. I mean, I was the subject of a political hit job. I now know that the investigation into me by Robert Mueller's dirty cops actually began on October 26, 2017, 3 months after Robert Mueller knew that there was no Russian collusion. The president wisely and very courageously in an election year recognized that, you know, I was only targeted not because I committed a serious crime, because they had hoped to turn me against him. They had hoped to so pressure me that I would change my testimony, lie, bear false witness against the president, and they would use me as a pawn in their impeachment coup. And I refused. I flatly refused. And the president recognized that not only had I remained truthful and loyal, but I was looking at being sent to a COVID-19 infested prison at age 67. With a history of asthma, it would have been a death sentence, George.
That would have gotten you, Raj. But you didn't fight the conviction at all. You didn't bring any witnesses or anything like that. How come?
Well, because the judge in my case, Amy Berman Jackson, so limited my defense that I had very few options. So, for example, I wanted to bring Bill Binney, the former NSA counterterrorism expert, IT expert, in because I wanted to use forensic evidence and his testimony of other former NSA experts, to prove that there never was any online hack of the DNC, that the underlying premise of my indictment was therefore false, that the information in question, the information that ended up in WikiLeaks, had been downloaded to some kind of portable drive or disk and taken out the back door. Judge Jackson would not allow that. I was also had an extraordinary limit she put on us. I was prohibited from raising the misconduct of the special counsel, that's Mueller, or the FBI, or the DOJ, or any member of Congress. Now, that's unconstitutional. We argued that, but the judge denied our arguments, and she allowed the government, therefore, to substantially limit our defense. And then lastly, as you know, those who lie to get about Congress, to Congress about material things, not things that matter, including Comey, Mueller, Brennan, McCabe, Rosenstein himself, Mueller himself, Hillary Clinton, Strzok, Page, many, many others, I was denied the ability to argue for selective prosecution as a defense argument. So it would be kind of like going into a prize fight with both hands tied behind your back, and then people who are watching say, well, that guy never threw a punch. It was literally impossible.
Well, get your life back together again. Your nightmare's over, Mr. Stone.
It is. Thank God for that. You know, I was never worried. I was never scared. Because back in January, I had the opportunity to meet Reverend Franklin Graham, the son of the late, great Billy Graham, who I think was one of the greatest people of the men of the 20th century. I knew that God would save me from those who persecuted me. I knew that the president would do the right thing in his mercy and in his justice and as an act of justice, and largely as a humanitarian act. And what happens, George? Well, all of a sudden, they're all back, every one of them. Mueller, Rosenstein, Adam Schiff. What a shady character that guy is. He's the worst huckster, the biggest con man I've seen in 40 years in American politics. And they're right back from the beginning. Roger Stone was a Russian spy. Roger Stone was in touch with Russian intelligence. You know, if that were true, they would have indicted me for it. They had full reign. I mean, they conducted a legal proctological examination on me. They had seen every email, every text, every phone call, gone through every record for the last 3 years. They could find no evidence of any of those crimes. So they basically fabricated this lied to Congress claim. And, you know, with a biased judge, a stacked jury, a jury forewoman who had posted social media throughout 2019 about attacking me directly, attacking the president, but attacking me directly, it was obvious that I could not get a fair trial. As my friend Tucker Carlson said, my trial was over before it began.
Well, you're free and clear now, and thank you for making yourself available to us tonight, Roger. Roger Stone, commuted by President Donald Trump a few days ago. Question number one is a $15 million internet infrastructure bond issue designed to bring high-speed internet service to primarily rural areas of Maine. Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the internet, with us. Lauren, what takes them so long?
Well, it's not a question of not wanting to do it. The problem is whether or not it can actually be done. I applaud this being up on the ballot in Maine, and I hope it passes. It's not a lot of money in the scheme of
things. No, $15 million is nothing for that state.
For the internet. The problem is that traditionally when these municipalities, either local cities or states, try to do something like this, they try to use public funds to build their own internet infrastructure, they're usually blocked because what happens is the big ISPs go to the FCC or the courts or both to try to block them, and they usually succeed. They claim that it's unfair competition. And because these ISPs have what amounts to virtual monopolies over their service areas, people end up stuck. So the fact that this is on the ballot and the fact that it may pass doesn't mean that this will ever get built, because usually these things end up in court, and those big ISPs have so much power, they usually get their way.
All right, Lauren. Lauren Weinstein, our expert on the internet. Actress Kelly Preston has died after losing her battle with breast cancer. Her husband, John Travolta, said this in a post on Instagram. She was 57 years old. She's been battling breast cancer for 2 years. Our condolences to her family. There's something unusual lurking out in the depths of space. Astronomers have discovered four faint objects that at radio wavelengths are highly circular, brighter than their edges, and they're unlike any class of astronomical object ever seen before. What are they? Nobody really knows. What else is going on in the skies? Let's check in with Stephen Gates Dr. Sky. Hi, Stephen.
Hello there, George. And we devote the entire segment and update here to the live sky, and for good reason, George, Comet Neowise. This has become one great comet, George. I don't know if you've had a chance to see it, but so many of the listeners are emailing me, and here we go.
It's quite
over
a sight.
The past week, we've come to know Comet Neowise, Comet 2020 F3. This one is literally came out of nowhere. The comet has gone from obscure to quite a memorable object. During the past week, the comet's been easy to see in the early morning sky. I'm up every morning watching it and taking pictures, and you can too, ladies and gentlemen. Low in the north-northeast sky, rising nearly at 4 a.m. local time. The comet is moving slowly to the early evening sky, so if you're not an early morning riser, good news for you. And by midweek, George, the comet should be visible low in the west-northwest sky in binoculars. Here's what's making this comet so bright. Astronomers have determined that the nucleus is probably 3 miles wide, fairly big for a comet. Comet Neowise is actually moving closer to the Earth, and right now as we speak, George, the comet is located in the constellation of Lynx, now 75 million miles from the Earth. It'll get closest to us on July the 23rd at a safe distance of 64 million miles. To view the comet, you'll need a clear view coming up this week of the west-northwest sky. Right after sunset, the comet will stand some 15 degrees above the horizon. You'll need a clear sky to see it, and to the left of the setting sun. In binoculars, George, the dust tail is around 7 degrees long, longer in dark skies, making it just an amazing object. And by Saturday, the comet moves into darker skies, locating it, of course, on star charts just below the bowl stars of the Big Dipper. We wrap it up, George, with more of the live sky. Tonight, ladies and gentlemen, is the night of Jupiter. Looking into the southeast sky, this bright object now, some 384 million miles away from us, it's best. And if you have a telescope, the sight is even better. To the right side of Jupiter, George, the satellites Europa and Callisto. On the left, Ganymede and Io. Also, the planet Saturn, just to the lower left of Jupiter. That comes to opposition in a few days. Wrapping it up, Venus, super bright in the northeast sky in the morning, next to the bright star Aldebaran. For more information, check our favorite websites, theskylive.com, wikisky.org, and we'd love the emails at drskyshow@gmail.com. Always remember, naturally, to keep your eyes to the skies. And, George, trying to continue to earn that opportunity here on this radio show and grateful for it, as your navigator on the highway to the heavens.
Thanks, Stephen. See, Dr. Sky. His website again, drdrsky.com. In a moment, Dr. Andrew Wakefield joins us. He put his career on the line to tell the world about vaccines, and he is next with us on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you. Dr. Andrew Wakefield with us is a doctor who was accused of scientific and medical malpractice because his discoveries opened up entirely new perceptions of childhood autism, the gut-brain link, the vaccine safety. Despite elaborate attempts at censorship, his documentary Vaxxed, From Cover-Up to Catastrophe, The Revelations of a Vaccine Scientist at the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, changed the public mindset on the truth about vaccine safety. His latest film is called 1986, The Act. We'll talk about that in a moment. Andrew Wakefield on Coast to Coast. Doctor, welcome to the program.
George, it's great to be back. Thank you very much.
It is. And when you went forward back years ago, and they chased you all over the place about your 1998 study. You fought it as much as you could, but tell us what happened.
Certainly. There were 13 of us, 13 physicians and scientists, and I encountered a group of children. Mothers called me and said my child was developing perfectly normally. They had speech-language interaction at the age of 18 months. They went and had a measles, mumps, rubella vaccine. I wasn't anti-vaccine. I took them there on the doctor's orders, and they got the vaccine on time. After that vaccine, they had a seizure or they slept for 3 days, and when they recovered, they were never the same again. They'd lost their speech, they'd lost their interaction, their language, their play with siblings, their eye contact. Everything had gone. The light in their eyes had gone out, and they were ultimately diagnosed with autism. I was a gastroenterologist at the time, and I led a big research team, and I said, how can I help? And they said, my child has terrible gastrointestinal issues, but the doctors and nurses that I've seen have put this down to autism. That's just autism. Get over it. Put him in a home. Forget about it. Move on. It was a tragic situation. Well, we investigated these children, and of course, the parents were right. As they always are, because they know their children best. The parents were right. The children had intestinal disease, which, when we treated it, led to improvement not only of their intestinal disease, but their autism as well, which was fascinating. That was the beginning of a very, very interesting journey. And so we had an absolute moral and professional obligation to take the vaccine association seriously. And all these years later, George, I am completely convinced that they are right, not least of which by virtue of the CDC's need to commit scientific fraud, as demonstrated in the film Vax, to cover up the fact that they'd found exactly that association.
Absolutely.
In their studies.
And isn't the biggest concern the cocktail of the MMR, the measles, mumps, and rubella? You wouldn't be that opposed if they were done singly as separate injections, right?
At the time, George, we did not see this. Parents didn't report this regression into autism following the single vaccine. It was the combined MMR. And when I looked into the safety studies of that combined vaccine, then they were appalling. They were absolutely appalling. And there'd been an assumption that you could just put these things together with no consequence at all. But one and one and one don't equal three. They equal something completely different when you're dealing with live biological agents like live vaccines. And the safety studies to determine that this combination was okay to give to children had not been done. And indeed, where they had been done, they'd identified problems. So at that time, my principal concern was the triple MMR vaccine. But the more I've gone on to research vaccines now, the deeper I've gone into it and the understanding of what's in these vaccines, the mercury, the aluminum, what are called adventitious viruses that should never be there, the contaminants, then I've become more and more concerned by the safety or lack thereof of the childhood vaccination program, particularly in this country.
Dr. Wakefield, do you think Big Pharma was behind them going after you initially?
I think without a shadow of a doubt, this is a situation where you have a sort of cartel between the pharmaceutical companies and the government. They share a common aim. And of course, the industry has the ability to do it. They recruited a journalist through Rupert Murdoch's media. Rupert Murdoch has huge interests in vaccination worldwide, and they put his son on the board, James Murdoch, on the board of GlaxoSmithKline, the UK's principal MMR manufacturer, as a non-executive director, and his job was to come after me, which he did. So was Big Pharma involved? Absolutely, for sure.
Why do you think Bill Gates is such into vaccines? He's either one of the most benevolent good guys on this planet, or he's one of the most misinformed. I'm not sure which.
Yes, I do not know. I mean, there is speculation that his interest in and his benevolence in vaccination policy and practice started when he was fighting antitrust cases. And somehow those evaporated. I don't know whether that's true or not, whether this was a sort of, you know, you help us and we'll help you. But he certainly committed to a draconian policy of vaccination worldwide, which has met with increasing resentment in third world countries, like in developing countries like India and various African countries, where they're now seeing a resurgence of, for example, poliomyelitis, paralytic polio, in the face of his use of the oral polio vaccine. So there is growing concern in many countries as to the actual benefits or harms that have flowed from his policies.
And I'm so concerned about this potential COVID vaccine, if and when they ever get it out. I'm not a vaccine booster by any means. I don't get the flu shot. I haven't had the flu in God knows how long, knock on wood. I don't tell people not to get it or to get it. It's up to them. It's their decision. But I don't. I try to stay away from as many of those vaccines as I can. I mean, I was pumped with them when I was a kid. I think I have the simian monkey virus in me when I got the shots back in the early 50s.
Yeah, that's an issue that we cover in the film. And people didn't know that, but there was this cancer-causing virus in In fact, in both the oral polio and the killed polio vaccine, so both the Salk and the Sabin vaccine that we had as children were contaminated, widely contaminated with a monkey virus.
Andrew, stay with us. We're going to take a quick break. We're going to bring in the producer of 1986 in a moment, Lori Martin Gregory, and we'll continue chatting with you. We'll take calls with you next hour on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Dr. Andrew Wakefield with us. We're going to bring in the producer of the film 1986, Lori Martin Gregory, in just a second. But Andrew, tell us a little bit about the film. I was able to find 1986. What was that significance? You were in Toronto at the time, weren't you?
That's right. That was the year that Ronald Reagan signed into law the National Childhood Vaccine Injury Act, which was a monumental event that gave liability protection for damage done by their vaccines to the vaccine makers for those vaccines that were on the recommended childhood vaccine schedule in the US. So they took the product out of the constraints of the free market. They took this industry out of the constraints of the free market. They took away any incentive for safety, and they gave them a free run at American children.
I'm going to bring in your producer of the film, of course, Lori Martin Gregory, who holds degrees in journalism and broadcasting. She's the CEO of Seventh Chakra Films and the producer of this movie, 1986, The Act. Lori, welcome to the program.
Thank you, George. What a pleasure to be here with you.
Now, the film is finished, and tell me the venue. How are you going to get it out to folks?
The film is finished, and it is up and available to stream on demand right now. It is 1986theact.com, and we're really pleased to be bringing this to the world on our own independent platform.
Are you happy with the way the film ended?
Oh, my gosh. It really is incredible. You know, when Andy asked me to come on board a year and a half ago, he really had a vision, and the film has come to be exactly what that vision was. And it's really demonstrating, I think, something that people can connect with globally. It's a universal message, you know, about the power of a mother's intuition to really understand, you know, how to guide through what is some very dangerous times. And I think Andy has really created a masterpiece.
What did you think of vaccines prior to getting involved in the film?
I was awake and aware about the dangers, and I had met and researched enough to know that, you know, really the bottom line for any individual is to educate themselves. And so I think, you know, for me, there just isn't a whole lot of compelling reason based on my history to know that that would be a good fit for me. And I think that what Andy is bringing forth in this movie is that everybody really needs to do their own homework. They need to understand what the history of vaccination is, how policy has created a really dangerous precedent of profit over people. And, you know, health freedom is really about knowing what's best for you and making your own choices.
And
so that's something we need to do more of.
And what do you think the reaction's going to be once it really gets out into the public?
Well, it's incredible because we've only been launched for about 5 days now, and we are receiving extraordinary reviews. It's being so well received, and, you know, I'm so proud of the film and the message that Andy has put together, because I think it's an important one, and it's one that's being received globally. We're getting such positive feedback, and we're seeing it be viewed all over the world. It's so exciting to see that people have an appetite and a curiosity to know this, and I think part of that is because of what we've experienced with COVID, and I think part of it is that, too, people are really ready to look and understand, look further and look deeply to understand exactly what the risk of vaccination is all about and what the history of it is.
Well, best luck with the film, Lori. Thank you for being on the program.
Thank you so much, George.
Absolutely. And the Robert F. Kennedy Jr., of course, is a very staunch advocate against vaccines as well. Has he supported any of your work?
So Bobby was a major part of this film. In fact, he wraps up the film. So absolutely, he's been wonderful.
Are there any vaccines out there that you would say, well, you know, this may work? Or are you opposed to all of them?
There are two elements to it. One, do they work? And two, are they safe? And those are interrelated. You know, I started off this, George, looking at the MMR. I wasn't anti-vaccine. My first two children received some of their childhood vaccines.
Mm-hmm.
But the closer I looked at it, the more concerned I became. And when I came to testify before Congress in 2001, before the Oversight Committee on Government Reform, I learned about the mercury in vaccines, and I thought no one would ever put mercury in vaccines. It's so toxic, and yet
they took them out of our fillings. It was so bad, right?
That's right. Well, they've still, you know, I don't know whether you can still get it, but it is one of the most toxic substances on planet Earth, and yet here we were injecting it into babies within the first 24 hours of life. It's astonishing. And then it got worse. I learned about the aluminum in vaccines, which potentiates the toxicity of mercury. So we had a toxic soup. We had a combination of things that had never been studied. I think this is the key element, George, is they had never been studied. The effects of these things in combination, their synergy, their interaction, their potential for cumulative toxicity had been completely ignored. And this issue is covered in the film, whereby the CDC and the agencies find an extraordinarily high association between mercury-containing vaccines and neurological injury in children, and they strive by any means available to them to cover it up and deny access to that information to the American public.
Why would these manufacturers of vaccines put this stuff in vaccines? I mean, did they actually think it works?
I don't know. It was grandfathered in. It sort of predated the Food and Drug Administration. So without any safety testing, mercury was grandfathered in. And what they did is they gave more and more mercury-containing vaccines without ever adding up the cumulative dose of mercury that children were getting, until the point where, when it was brought to their attention, children were getting way in excess of the EPA's guidelines for toxicity on adults. And then they panicked. Did they withdraw it immediately? No, they phased it out. They recommended that manufacturers should remove it because they wanted to protect the vaccine program, and they didn't want to cause undue alarm in parents whose children they'd poisoned.
If you pull something immediately, it makes the world wake up.
That's exactly right.
And what about legislation now that protects Big Pharma from any of these problems?
Well, this really, I believe, and this is why I made the movie, is at the root, is at the heart of all of the current problems that we are witnessing with vaccines worldwide today, including the threat of global mandates for a COVID-19 vaccine. And it's really a story about how bad policies about unsafe vaccines hurt children everywhere. And you know, George, once you take a product out of the free market, then you make it mandatory. You give business the perfect business model.
Yep.
You give the manufacturers a perfect business model of a mandatory market, no liability. All they can do is profit, which they did in enormous amounts. They expanded the vaccine program dramatically because they had no liability, and they made a huge profit. They became so powerful globally. They became so wealthy that they could buy the politicians, they could buy the media, they could buy the doctors. And at that point, they owned it all. And at the heart of it was this act which made that happen.
Are our individual states here in the United States all different in terms of compelling people to get vaccines or not?
Yes, there are three forms exclusions from vaccines, for ways of not having your child vaccinated: religious exemption, philosophical exemption, and medical exemptions. And there is a move, a big move now, to push to remove all of those exemptions except the most rarefied medical exemptions. Literally, a child has to have had a near fatal reaction to a vaccine to be able to get an exemption. So they're pushing, and this is again pushed by the industry, pushed by the pharmaceutical yep. industry lobby, to take away these exemptions so that they have a captive market to all of the children in this country without interference from their parents.
How big, money-wise, is the vaccine market?
Well, it's predicted to be $100 billion
My God.
Within a few years' time. It's huge. But the big money is not only from the front end, the vaccines, but from the treatments that are necessary or given to for the immune diseases, the neurological problems, the psychological problems that arise as a consequence of vaccines that are on the product insert as listed side effects of the vaccines. And this is where the industry makes the vast majority of its profit.
I wear a mask now only because I don't want people feeling bad next to me. I'm doing it more for them than me. I may be wrong. You know, maybe masks do work, but I'm not sure with COVID-19. What are the possibilities, Andrew, that they will make vaccines mandatory for COVID-19?
Well, that is the desire. That is the push by so many people, Gates, Fauci, not President Trump, who has said that it should be a choice, and it must be a choice. There is absolutely no place anywhere in the world at any time for forced medical procedures.
No.
We must have medical autonomy, health autonomy, and they are pushing to take that away. And I think what we're seeing is the systematic subjugation of other potential treatments like hydroxychloroquine, zinc, vitamin C, in favor of pushing the vaccine agenda. For vaccines, strategies which have never been used before in humans, RNA strategies, DNA strategies, Frankenstein viruses, which frankly I wouldn't touch in a million years.
I mean, I envision them saying you must get a vaccine and you'll get a card which you can show at the, you know, when you go through a TSA line at the airport that says you've been vaccinated and you can therefore get through the same as you show your ID when you show them your boarding pass. I think they're going to do things like that.
Yes, they are. And in fact, there's a program in Argentina at the moment, which is a sort of test run on this. Your vaccine record is attached to your personal ID. And in order to get a driver's license or go to a football game or anything, you have to function in society, then you have to be fully vaccinated. And that is what they intend to do. They intend to monitor us globally by microchip or by personal ID to make sure that we are compliant with their schedule.
I believe that the COVID-19 was developed in a laboratory in Wuhan, China. It probably got out accidentally. How, I'm not sure. But what do you think about the possibility that it was created in a lab, except for
not by nature? No, I don't know about it at all. Yeah. I'll tell you a story, George. Years ago, when I was working at the Royal Free, just after I left, SARS broke out. The respiratory distress associated with the coronavirus infection. And we were dealing with an ex-member of MI5, the British Secret Service at the time, and his job was as an Uber hacker. He could hack into anything at any time. We didn't work with him ultimately because what he did, so much of what he did was actually sort of marginal in the sort of gray zone. But he came to us one day and he said, there's been an earthquake in central China that has damaged or destroyed the bioweapons facility, and that's the origin of this virus. Well, he immediately got a call from one of his minders to say, you will forget that you ever read that and never mention it again. And
wow.
So that was a very interesting story. He had no reason to tell me other than it was an interesting anecdote that he'd managed to glean from his hacking. But when that happened, and then it happened again, and they said it was due to a bat in the market within, you know, half a mile of the bioweapons facility in Wuhan. No, there are no coincidences. I agree with you entirely. And now the French, amongst others, have confirmed using molecular sequencing technology that, yes, indeed, there are characteristics of this virus that are that come from the laboratory. So that has always been my belief. I don't know how it got out. As you say, it could have been an accident. It could have been deliberate. I don't know that we'll ever know that.
But, and it spreads so fast. I mean, you know, some people believe it's a hoax and it isn't out there. Well, I think it's out there. People are dying from this thing. But how could it spread so quickly across this planet?
Well, I think that there are two elements to this. One is that there was a delay in the acknowledgement that there was such a problem, and this, you know, has emerged from the sort of World Health Organization's interaction with the Chinese. So there was a delay in people talking about it, being made aware of it, and therefore allowing it to spread. And therefore, and the other thing is that international travel, particularly from, you know, from Wuhan back to the United States of America, allowed that to happen very, very quickly. I mean, it's just sort of, you know, after a 12-hour flight, you've got the problem in America. So it these things have the capacity to spread, and if they've been mutated in the lab to make them more easily infectious,
right,
in the human body, then you've got a problem.
I said back in January it was airborne. I'm not a biologist or an epidemiologist or anything like that. I'm a news talk show host. But I said, this is airborne. It's happening way too quickly. People aren't just spitting on other people. It's in the air. And I think I'm right.
I think you may well be right, George.
Yeah, just unbelievable situation. What do people do during this kind of situation? They're shutting down businesses again in California. People are going crazy, doctor. They're going crazy.
Yes, I think there is a, when this sort of thing first comes to public attention, it's entirely appropriate that the administration takes, you know, a sort of a hard line, strict measures. We don't know anything about this. We're going to accumulate the data as quickly as possible to make decisions. But in the meantime, we need to limit the spread. Now, that's fine. But as soon as you have that information that enables you to make rational decisions, and that's what you need to do. And I've always felt that we need these coronaviruses spread. They have a limited lifespan, that we need to deal with it. We need to protect those who are at high risk, the elderly and others, and we need to allow other people to get it. The young people who survive it and have no problems with it, we need them to get it in order to establish a high level of natural herd immunity. Now, there are arguments for and against that, but that has been my belief, because you're not going to contain it in a way that is economically viable. And we've seen that, and we've seen an extraordinary effect on the economy. It will, you know, it will be a legacy that will haunt our children and our grandchildren for years to come. And it has hurt a lot of people. And Trump said way back, you know, let's not make the cure worse than the cause. And I fear that is exactly where we're headed now.
And nobody talks about the seasonal flu that, you know, unfortunately kills upwards of 60,000 Americans every year.
Yes. I mean, when you look at the data on this disease now, it is no worse than a seasonal flu. And yet we don't shut the economy down for seasonal flu.
Exactly.
I think, you know, policy, bad policy has led to an unacceptable level of mortality. And we've seen this with Cuomo's New York, where taking patients who are convalescing and putting them back in old folks' homes to infect those who are in those homes, where we know the mortality is highest.
We're going to take calls with you, Andrew, when we come back in just a moment. Whether you are for vaccines, against them, you've got your right to make that phone call. Dr. Andrew Wakefield with us. Their latest film is called 1986, The Act. The website is linked up at coasttocoastam.com.